Wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear.
Of Clouds Below Your Knees by Ray Lynch. And what does that mean? That means it's Wednesday, 8 p.m., and time for So What's Your Story? The only program originating in Houston developed entirely to storytelling right here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM. I'm your host, Mary Edgerton, and alongside our whole fairy tale village, co-hosts Greg Audell, Warren Holloman, and Rank Hubachek, engineer Nicole Rocherlin, intern Tatiana Gago, and our assistant Teddy Puig, we celebrate the power of story by placing the spotlight on tellers who take us on excursions through enchanted worlds and through windows of their souls with personal stories that stretch the boundaries of the human heart. First, let me wish everyone a happy Hanukkah. This is a discussion going on between me and Hank. I, who was married to a Jewish man and have celebrated lots of Hanukkahs, and so I know how to look it up on the web, and Hank, who is actually Jewish and told me that Hanukkah ended last night, but according to the web, it actually ends tonight at sundown. Okay, so there's no gift giving tonight because it ends before you have candles and gift giving, but during the daylight hours, it was still Hanukkah today. Okay, I'm done with that. Happy Festivus for December 18th. I don't know if anybody vented on that date, but that's supposed to be Festivus. It's all about venting. Happy Winter Solstice for tomorrow. Happy Christmas for December 25th. Happy Kwanzaa starting December 26th. And shall we just say happy holidays to all for the month of December. And my gift to all of you tonight is a new storyteller on the Houston storytelling scene. Jennifer Hoisington was the October winner of the Moth Story Slam when she told us a delightfully creepy story with some great animal impressions. She is new to the Houston storytelling scene, but I think a longtime storyteller. Tonight, she is our very own guest here on So What's Your Story? Jennifer has a BA in theater arts from Brigham Young University, and she spent time in theater, mostly directing and stage management. She is married to a former camp director for the YMCA Camp Greenville in the Blue Ridge Mountains in northwestern South Carolina and for the YMCA Storer Camps in central Michigan. And she spent many years being, as she calls it, the first lady of summer camp. So we're going to hear some stories tonight from camp life, starting with a set of stories presented as variations on A Midsummer Night's Dream. This is my absolute favorite of Shakespeare's plays. I mean, for one, I love fairies. I grew up with my mother telling me how she used to go over turning over leaves under trees to find fairies. This play is set in the woodlands and involves intertwining stories of tiny fairy folk from the woodlands, a sprite named Puck who sets about bewitching fairies and humans alike, Oberon, the king of the fairies, and he's a macho man, I gotta tell ya. And finally, the playful, fun-loving fairies themselves. Jennifer, welcome to the show. Is this your first time on radio?
Thank you. Yes. Yes, this is my first time on the radio. I'm excited to be here.
I'm excited to have you. I'm excited to be your host. So I think with your background in theater, you're going to be a natural. So tonight, you're going to talk about variations on A Midsummer Night's Dream. But tell us how you ended up in camp life.
Okay. This was 2009, I think, was our first camp stint. My husband had been an elementary school teacher for several years, and he had also worked in YMCA day camps, and he was losing some of the magic of teaching in the school setting, and hearkening back to his days as at the YMCA, and really wanted to see about possibly working in a summer camp, in a residential summer camp setting. And so we decided to give it a go, and he applied for several camp director positions, where a camp director can usually take their family with them. We had two small boys at the time. And he was hired by YMCA Camp Greenville in a gorgeous part of South Carolina, Blue Ridge Mountains, Appalachian Territory. And so we left the world of suburbia and everything else behind. We downsized and moved into a little 800 square foot dilapidated cottage in the woods, and commenced our life with our two boys. We moved there. They were 1 and 3. So we joined the camp life.
800 square feet. Now, that's a tiny house. That's a tiny place to have two little boys.
Yes.
Also. So your first story you described to me as one called Fairyland. So Camp Life Fairyland, you want to tell us this story?
Yeah, when we moved up there, I just had some experiences that really made me want to dub the place Fairyland. And I looked back at my blog and found this entry I had done that, you know, with my theater background, it spoke to me about Fairyland. So this is a short blog post that I wrote several years ago, once I'd arrived, shortly after arriving in Fairyland. I once lived in Fairyland. They didn't mention that in the job description my husband applied for, but I suppose you can't blame people who live in Fairyland for not recognizing it, or perhaps they just don't want the secret to get out. A few weeks ago, I took a walk down a rhododendron-shrouded path late at night in my pajamas, and they were everywhere, hundreds of them. I mentioned it to someone, and they said, "Oh, yeah, you've never seen that before?" "No, I'm from the West." The other day, I even encountered Oberon. It was early morning, out near the chapel. He ran right across the road in front of me, stopped, looked at me for a few seconds. I stopped and met his gaze. He may not have looked like himself that day, but I saw him, and he knows. I ran into Puck yesterday. Scared me. I screamed. He squealed. He popped right out of the trash compactor. I wasn't expecting that. He winked at me and scampered off. I'm hoping to catch a glimpse of Queen Mab at some point. I hear she keeps pretty much to herself, though.
So Puck is absolutely one of my favorite characters in A Midsummer Night's Dream, and he's a sprite, and he's mischievous, and he's constantly putting a love potion on the wrong person who wakes up and sees a person that they're not supposed to fall in love with, and they're madly in fault. They fall madly in love with that person. So tell us about Puck.
Puck's a trickster. So when I moved to Fairyland, I discovered pretty quickly that there was no garbage service. So the way we disposed of garbage, and I had, again, mind you, two boys in diapers, we disposed of garbage by driving about a mile down the road, turning off in an unmarked driveway and proceeding back into the forest a little ways, and then you came to a big dumpster attached to a trash compactor and a little platform, a little wooden platform, and you'd grab your bag of garbage and you'd climb up on that platform and stick your magic key in the slot, turn it and push a button, and the compactor would slowly open, and you'd throw your trash in and you'd push the button and it would slowly close, and you keep it closed because you don't want the critters getting into it, and you don't want your garbage to hang out of your house very long. There's lots of critters in Fairyland. So one day I was doing this mundane task. I'd gone out to the dump, as we called it, and lazily waiting for that compactor to open, push the button, and began to pull back. And suddenly, this raccoon jumped up out of the compactors, like 6 inches from my face. I don't know, he'd been hiding in there, and I screamed, and I think he was just as startled as I was. He looked at me, and he squealed, and then he jumped out of the compactor and ran off into the forest. And I stopped and waited to see if anything else was going to jump out, and I started laughing. It was just the most absurd thing. And I threw my trash in the compactor and closed it up and went about my day, but I felt like I'd witnessed something unique that day.
Oh, that was Puck, yes, definitely creating mischief in the forests. And I tell you, I'm a big fan of finding raccoon YouTube videos with raccoons doing funny things like stealing blankets from people's cat and dog rooms. Well, That was a great way to consider an encounter with a raccoon, a magical character, and they do have the cutest of little rubber bandit faces.
Yes.
But tell me now how you met Oberon. And you know, I love A Midsummer Night's Dream, and so I've seen it, two different versions of it now, and I decided to go back and read the synopsis again, and there's a whole lot of writing about it on Wikipedia, and Oberon is actually quite a macho, anti-feminist character, so that intrigued me. So tell me about your encounter with Oberon.
So, you're right. I imagine Oberon, I think of a macho, manly man who likes to fight sometimes. But when we moved to Fairyland, we were told that the black bears in the area were shy and usually left people alone. So my first encounter with a black bear, I used to go walking in the mornings with another camp wife, and we'd walk up to the chapel. The chapel was etched into the mountainside and overlooked this beautiful valley up there. It was beautiful, but we were walking up towards the chapel, we rounded a bend, and suddenly there was this large black bear crossing the road in front of us. And we stopped, and the bear stopped and looked at us, and we all held our breath for a moment, and then the bear looked away and ambled right across the street, and surprised us. But we moved on our way and had a pretty peaceful encounter. My second encounter with the black bear at Camp Greenville was a little more disconcerting. Like I said, you have to take care of your trash, or it attracts bears, and I wasn't very good at that, because I was producing lots of trash between my little family, and I decided to keep, be a good idea to keep a garbage can outside my bedroom window area, and I lashed it to the fence there, and I lashed the lid onto a bungee cord, thinking this will be bear proof, right? If I forget to take it one day, or run out of time and energy to take it to the dump. And one morning, early, I don't know, middle of the night, I'm laying there and I have a cat that started running across the room, jumping on my head to look out one window and across the bed and looking out the other window and freaking out. And I woke up, of course, and I noticed that the motion light just outside my bedroom window had been triggered and was on. And I sit up and I look out the window, and there is another enormous black bear chomping on my trash. He had managed, of course, to peel that trash can away from the fence and peel the lid right off, and he was dining on cat poop and diapers. And I thought, well, what do I do? Everyone says make yourself look really big and tell them to sternly to go away. And so I opened the window. The window was open. I yelled, "Shoo, bear, shoo!" And he just turned his head and looked at me and turned back and kept munching on the diapers. And so my husband was awake by this time, and I said, "What do we do?" And I remember my kids sleeping in the next room, and I ran there, shut their windows, and my husband grabbed a pan from the kitchen and came to the window and started banging the pan, and the bear would just look at us and keep going. And I went to the front door and I started turning on and off the porch lights and opening and closing the door, and the bear just didn't care. And so finally I said, "Well, what do we do?" My husband's like, "Well, I wouldn't suggest cleaning up the trash now. Just go back to sleep." Well, good luck falling asleep. So I laid back down and I laid there and looked out the window at the bear and watched him eat his dinner. And after a few minutes, he ambled away, and the light went off, and then he came back for seconds, and the light went back on, and finally he went away for the night. He'd had enough, and in the morning I had quite a mess to clean up.
Oh my gosh, I bet. You know, I lived in New Jersey, but never encountered a bear there. I did go hiking in, I guess it was New Hampshire, Vermont one time, and I do remember walking along with this, oh, the scenery is beautiful, and my mind is wandering, and I'm not even thinking. And all of a sudden, some very big object comes crashing down in the woods beside me. And I think it was a bear, because it seemed to be I don't think it was a moose. And I thought, as you know, I saw it, and I ran up the path away from it, and it ran down the path away from me, and I had the feeling that maybe it was as scared as me as I was of it.
We can hope.
Yes, we can hope. But yes, with Oberon, I think your bear was playing the Oberon role of, you know, I'll be happy to take over. So I just want to mention to our radio audience, you're listening to Jennifer Hoisington, our guest and the First Lady of Fairyland, telling us stories about life in the wild here on So What's Your Story this Wednesday night at 8 p.m. As you have heard many other storytellers right here on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 in Huntsville. I'm your host, Mary Edgerton, here with Jennifer Hoisington. So, now, Oberon is the mighty king of the fairies. So where do the fairies fit into the tale?
So this story is how I really came to dub the place Fairyland. Some days, I'm sure all parents relate to this, you feel like a decent parent, and other days you just don't. And this story, this particular day, I felt like I'd kind of grasped something important about being a parent, and I felt like I was doing okay. This was about a year, a little over a year into our stay into Fairyland, and the new summer camp staff had just arrived, and we were having a welcoming campfire that evening, and so the camp director's family was invited, and so I pushed them a little stroller and brought my two little boys all the way around the other side of the lake over the stony pathways, and we were all in our pajamas, and Elliot, my two-year-old at that time, had dressed up in a shiny carnival mask from the dress-up bin and had his little blankie around his shoulders and his little tiger flashlight clutched tight, and my four-year-old Ethan was wearing his pajamas too and touting his flashlight, and all the summer camp counselors, these college-age girls, just couldn't get enough of my little boys. And I look over there at one point, we're sitting around the campfire, and Ethan snuggled up against one of these counselors, and everybody's just in awe of these cute little boys, and we sang silly songs and important songs, and we had s'mores, and it was just a lovely night. Then we made our way back to our cottage in the dark. And between the amphitheater and the house, the cottage, is a rhododendron-lined path, and the rhododendrons actually form like a tunnel, and so it got really dark in there if you turned off your flashlights. And this area of Appalachia is known for a particular unique type of firefly. It's called the blue ghost firefly, and they come out in May or early June when it starts to get warm, and they're not like your normal firefly. Most other fireflies I've seen fly at various heights and they blink on and off, but the blue ghost fireflies, they hover at about knee height and they emit a constant steady blue light. And they're found all throughout Appalachia, but they're heavily concentrated in this area where this camp was. And I'd heard about these, and so on our way back from this campfire, we stopped in this rhododendron-lined tunnel, and my boys turned off their flashlights, and we just waited. And these fireflies swarmed the stroller, I just remember thinking at that time, I remembered all the things we'd given up in leaving our regular life in the suburbs, condensing down to 800 square feet and just getting rid of all the trappings of life. And my thoughts were such that, in a world full of gadgets and gizmos and constant noise and rush to get more and of the things that don't matter, we forget about the things that really do matter. And at times like that moment, surrounded by those fairies, they look like fairies to me. That's all I could think of is, wow, we're surrounded by little blue fairies. I remember why we chose to give up so much of that life, of that other life. And I listened to Ethan's amazement and Elliot's tired giggle. And I thought, we are blessed with very little in the way of material wealth at that time. Yet somehow on that night, I felt richer than all the kings in the world.
You know, I have to say, you told me that story, and I actually went and Googled the blue ghost, and these pictures are amazing. I mean, you would have thought that someone had painted this, and they're actual photographs, that someone had painted this picture of fairies. That's exactly what they look like, with the blue light that they're emitting the whole time. So I would encourage all our listeners out there, go Google an image of the the blue ghost
firefly.
Yes, and or even on YouTube there was. And be careful with YouTube because they'll give you lots of different fireflies, and you want the blue ghost firefly mm-hmm. because their light is on all the time. So, aside from the fact that I'm ready to vacation in South Carolina next June, I do want to remind our listeners, we're not in fun driving time, and we're all happy to hear that, and we had a great fun drive, which we thank all of you about, but just if you're thinking about it, it's Christmas time, and it's the end of the year. If you want to go to kpft.org, you can hit that Donate Now button, and if you do, you can scroll down, and you can find our show, So What's Your Story? And just let our folks here know that you appreciate our stories, because stories reach beyond borders, and they connect us to other realities or non-realities, as the case may be. So, Tatiana, tell us about some storytelling connections in our community.
Oh, yes. First, let's start with the Houston Storytellers Guild, because it's the best group to work with to start cultivating your storytelling talent. Just get to their monthly story swaps held on the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at Temple Emanuel at 1500 Sunset. You can go to their website, www.houstonstorytellers.org, for upcoming events and all our past So What's Your Story programs. Every show since 2008 listed on the menu under radio program. Also, if you don't have a radio, it's no excuse for missing our show, because you can listen to us stream live on kpft.org and Facebook Live. Tell us what you think about our show or suggest program ideas by visiting our So What's Your Story Facebook page. And we promise to get back to you. And please be sure to share our page with your friends, your families, your lovers, and your enemies. And we'd love it if you like us when you leave. Check out our program clips on YouTube, and don't miss our friends at the Moss at Warehouse Live. The next event is January 9th, 2018, and the theme is ambition.
Yeah, that ambition one kind of scares me. Don't know what to do about that. So what's up for next week here at So What's Your Story?
Well, Mary, Greg Audell is up next week. His guest is going to be Joseph Epicia, and he will be here on December 27th, just before we get ready to start our new year.
Oh, a new year coming up. Okay. Any plans from the back office there? Any new resolutions? Tatiana? Hank?
Possibly go to the gym more.
That's
yeah,
all.
And I'm going to be looking up the actual dates for Jewish holidays. I'm going to be trying to get that down. And by the way, Joseph is not going to be the only guest. Greg is really working up a really fun program for next week, but Joseph will be here.
Oh, okay, good. Well, that's fun. It's a lot of fun with a lot of people. Hank, I'm going to go head-to-head with you as an information person, as somebody who mm-hmm. really goes to find the information and get it and understand it. I'm going to go head-to-head with you on these dates.
Okay.
Okay. And
you won this one. That's all right. You know, there may be a rabbi or two that calls in and disagrees, but, you know, they don't know everything either.
In the daytime hours today, it
daytime
was
hours. That's
as
right.
As soon as the sun went down, it wasn't. So,
but you know, but you know, my motto was no gift, no holiday. That's it. Right. That's it. That's what I say.
Oh, let me tell you, I raised a blended family of Catholics and Jews, and so we did 8 gifts at Hanukkah, and presents at Christmas time, as my Jewish stepson said to me, "Well, Mary, do you think that since you're Christian that maybe Santa Claus will visit our house?" And so I find myself out shopping for Christmas and Hanukkah. Oh, I know all about it. And speaking of kids, how are your holidays shaping up, Jennifer?
Well, it's been an interesting season so far. We got the flu for Christmas. My household has been wrecked by the flu, but we're all healing nicely. We're getting ready to fly out to Salt Lake City to see cousins and celebrate my parents' 50th wedding anniversary next week. So we're excited for that.
Oh, wonderful. You know, I was in Salt Lake in September, and that is quite a cosmopolitan city.
It is.
They have quite a foodie culture there.
It's come a long ways.
Yes. And I had to go see the Great Salt Lake because the archaebacteria that I wrote my PhD thesis on grow in that Great Salt Lake. So definitely had to do that. But speaking of family, I think you mentioned you have 2 little boys, 12 and 14.
Mm-hmm.
And do you have a holiday story?
I do. I dug up a holiday story. Let me clarify. Elliot will be 12 next month, so don't want to give him his 12 props before they're due, but he'll be 12 soon. I pulled out this story, and I called it Merry Christmas, M-A-R-Y. This is another story from Camp Greenville, from Fairyland. As I said, my husband was a school teacher for several years. He taught 4th, 5th, and 6th grades, and as part of the usual curriculum in that time frame, there's the generally what we called, when I was growing up, the maturation unit, and the sex ed unit, when kids are first introduced to the parts of the body. And so in our house, we take sex education very seriously. As my husband likes to say, it's not a conversation. It's not a talk you have. It's an ongoing dialogue. And when your kids ask questions when they're little, you give age-appropriate answers using the proper terminology. And so the reason my husband really enjoyed teaching those units, he always said, is because it's the one time you have the room full of fifth graders' undivided attention.
I bet, yeah.
So it's no surprise that when our own children started asking questions, my husband always wanted to jump in. For example, when my youngest son was born, we took him in for his first well baby checkup, and Ethan, my older son, was with us, and we're in the waiting room, and a woman asks Ethan, says, is that your baby? He says, yeah. And she says, is it a baby brother or a sister? And he stares blankly because he didn't know what a sister was. And we said, is Elliot a boy or a girl? And Ethan says, oh, he has a penis. He is a boy. So we use the terminology. And I used to take Ethan to my doctor's visits when I was pregnant with Ellie, and I had to be very careful which ones I'd take him to, because he always wanted to figure out how everything works, and he would like to imitate afterwards. So I got lots of sonogram visits by my 4-year-old after my appointments, and even down he'd pretend to squirt stuff on me and say, Mommy, this is going to be cold. So when Ethan was about 4 and Elliot was around 2, we were coming back up the mountain. Everything was down the mountain a good half an hour, 45 minutes from Fairyland to get anywhere. Well, it was a Sunday in December, and we were coming back from church, we had the kids in Sunday school had performed a little nativity scene, and I'd helped out by, I had the baby doll in a box. I was standing behind Mary in the right moment. I handed the baby doll to the child playing Mary, and on our way back to camp, Ethan says to me, he says, Mom, can we play that game again? And I said, what game? He says, you know, Mary and Joseph. And I said, oh, okay, sure, we can do that on Christmas Eve. He says, okay. And then he said, but I want to be Mary. I said, okay. And he says, Mom, next time you shouldn't stand behind Mary. I said, oh, well, I wanted to give her the baby. I had the baby in the box. I'll make sure she had the baby at the right time. And he says, so the box was like Mary's tummy? I said, well, yeah, I guess you can say that. He says, Mom, how did the baby get out of her tummy without a hospital? And I said, well, back then they didn't have hospitals and doctors like we do today, so her husband Joseph had to help get the baby out. Well, how does the baby get out? And my husband, of course, who'd been waiting for this moment, jumps in, the educator, and he says, she had to push the baby out of a hole. And Ethan says, her belly button? No, it's a special hole near her bottom made for babies. Well, how did Joseph get it closed? Well, the hole closes by itself. Well, how big is it? It's pretty small, but it stretches big enough for the baby to come out, then stretches small again. Does it hurt? He asked. Yes, I said. But Dad said, Mom had some special medicine when you were born, so it didn't hurt so much. Easy for Dad to say. Do you still want to be Mary, honey?
Right.
I didn't really ask him that.
Think it through, baby.
Yeah. He says, only mommies have that hole since only they have babies in their tummies. That's correct. Daddies don't have that hole. They just have penises. Why don't daddies have babies in their tummies? Well, my thoughts went, well, God knew they couldn't handle the pain, son. But I didn't say that. My husband replied that daddies have other jobs, and we talked a little bit about what daddies do and mommies do, and it progressed into a long, drawn-out discussion of exactly how the umbilical cord functions, and another promise to get a book at the library. My son was a learner. He had to know how everything worked. So come Christmas Eve, we, as promised, we did the nativity. Ethan got to dress up as Mary with a little blue wrap on him, and we brought out the stuffed animals who played the sheep and the giraffe. Apparently, stuffed giraffe got to play himself because in this stable, we had giraffes, I was informed. Elliot, the two-year-old, we tried to get to play Joseph. He mainly wandered around dismantling the stable and undressing the baby and letting the sheep free, at which point Mary began to beat Joseph. And we then decided unanimously that it was Joseph's bedtime. So Matt took Joseph in to put him to bed. And Ethan says, "Can we do that again, Mom?" He was really fascinated with the story, I guess. And I said, "Sure. I could be," he says, "but who will be Joseph?" And I said, "Well, we can wait till Dad's back, or I can be Joseph." He said, "No, Joseph had to go to a meeting for 8 days, so Mary will just take care of the baby by herself." I said, 8 days, huh? Hopefully he'll show up for the circumcision. So that was my Mary story.
I think your son had a little idea about the roles of men and women or how they play it out.
He was figuring it out.
Yes. Yes. I remember when I had my first daughter one of my in-laws had said to me, "Well, it's very nice to involve your husband. And so when you wake up in the middle of the night to feed the baby, get your husband to go get the baby and put her in a clean diaper so she can eat clean and bring her to you. And then after you finish, change her diaper again and put her back to bed." So this was one of these, I mean, my baby was maybe about 5 or 6 days old, and we hear her crying, and I knock Mark and I say, "Okay, Mark, time to go get the baby." And he sits up and he said, "I would, but I think if I pick her up, I'm going to drop her because I'm so tired." I just thought, what a way to get out of this. We had a deal going. No.
Never worked well for me either, that deal.
Yes. Oh, from the mouths of babes. And then just one other story I remember is teaching one of my stepsons about nature, about babies. And I was teaching him about mammals. And I said, in the animal kingdom of mammals, mammals have their babies live. The mommies have their babies live. They don't lay eggs, and then they feed them. And these are mammals. And so he was pretty excited about that. And so he was about 4, and we went to visit my family. And he was all proud of his newfound knowledge. And he says to my mother, "Do you know what mammals are?" And she says, "Well, what are mammals?" And he says, "Mammals are, you know, ladies who have their babies live and they feed them." And my mother, thinking on the lines of mankind being the general term, she says, "Oh, so men are mammals." And he thinks about it and he says, "No, women are mammals. Men are just animals." So it is the true wisdom of that. Now, we've talked a lot about the wonderful fairyland that you and your family lived in, and of course your son Ethan's introduction to motherhood. And I'd like to throw out here the story that you told at the Moth in October, which was creepy, which is it's not tonight's theme, but it's such a wonderful story.
Sure.
You up for that?
Absolutely. It was a really fun night at the Moth. So obviously, we've talked about for several years that my husband was a summer camp director. This story comes from a couple of years we spent at Storer camps in Michigan. So we're away from fairyland. We're in Michigan, rural Michigan. We were living in a farmhouse that was built in the late 1800s. It was the original fieldstone basement and fieldstone foundation dirt basement. But with my husband as the camp director, I decided that that made me the first lady of summer camp. And so that's the title I gave myself. And in all my encounters with various wildlife and critters over the years at camp, I felt like I generally handled myself with the decorum that my office as first lady required, my encounters with the bears and the raccoons and all that. Until this one night in Michigan when I lost it. It was It was early June, I believe, and my boys were asleep in their bedroom downstairs in our farmhouse, and I was asleep in my bedroom upstairs. My husband, conveniently, was asleep in a cabin across the lake with a bunch of camp counselor trainees, and so we were left to our own devices. At about 2 a.m., my son Elliot, who was about 4 at the time, he comes into my bedroom and he wakes me up. He says, Mom, I hear a bat in my room. I'm like, there's not a bat in your room. Go back to sleep, sweetheart. No, Mom, there's a bat in my room. I can hear it. Okay, fine. Stay here. So I get up and I leave him in my room and I go down and I check out his room and there is no bat. So I start trudging up the stairs to tell him to get back to bed, and then I hear it too. And it's getting louder as I climb the stairs. And I look up and I see this little tiny bat dangling upside down from the door jamb into my bedroom under which I'd just come. And I freaked out. This little tiny bat to me looked like it had just huge claws and teeth, and I imagined rabies and all these things. And I lost it. And I yelled to my son. I'm like, close the door and stay in my bed. Don't come out, no matter what you hear on this side of the door. And I dashed across the landing to the office, and I opened up the window and took out the screen, and I waited for the bat to fly out, and it didn't. It just hung there. And oh, well, now what do I do? And so I ducked back downstairs to take stock of my resources and, you know, figure out what I'm going to do. And I looked around, and I found a roll of duct tape and a broom and a pair of gloves and a hoodie. Sweatshirt, and then I found as fortune would have it, an 8-foot cardboard shipping tube that my kids had been using for a matchbox car tunnel. So I channeled MacGyver, and I taped the broom to the end of the shipping tube, so I had this 12-foot makeshift extendo pole, and then I donned the gloves and tucked them into the hoodie, and I pulled the hoodie way down on my face, so all the only exposed skin on my entire body were my eyeballs, and I took this extendo pole and I extended it up the stairs, and I could just barely reach the bat from my safe distance, 12 feet away at the bottom of the stairs, and I started trying to pry that bat off the door jamb, and he was holding on for dear life, and I'm just trying to pull him off, and he gets one of his little claws into the broom bristles, and so now he's stretched between the door jamb and the broom bristles, and I swear I hear him cry, "Help me!" And I'm like, no mercy, and I pull that broom all the way and over, and I pull him up, pry him off the door jamb, and now he's clinging, the bat is clinging entirely to my broom bristles, and I hear him, and I'm thinking, help me, and I'm like, no mercy, but now what do I do? I had this bat on the broom, and I don't know what to do. I didn't have a plan that far, and so I managed to angle the broom out the door, across the landing, and out the window in the office that I'd opened previously. And I expected him just to fly away, and he didn't. And so I started banging the broom handle on the windowsill, thunk, 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 and pretty soon, he's holding on now by one little claw again, dangling there. Help me! And so I think, no mercy, and I thunk it one more time, and the bat drops into the darkness, and I rush over and slam the window shut and go back to bed. And the next morning, I get on the phone, and I call maintenance at camp, and I said, yes, this is the first lady. I didn't really say that, but that's what I thought. I said, we have a problem. And by that afternoon, I had Trapper Bob out at my house, and we were walking the perimeter of the house, and he was pointing out to me that these large piles of what I had always thought was rich Michigan farm soil abutting my house was actually bat guano, indicating I had about 1,000 bats, a colony living inside the walls of my house. And the bad news was that it was June, there were a bunch of baby bats in there, so he couldn't get them out right now, because you exterminate them by luring the bats out and locking them out essentially while they're out feeding, and the baby bats can't fly, so they would just die in the walls, which Trapper Bob convinced me would be a worse thing than having 1,000 live bats in my walls. So I mustered all the decorum I could as First Lady of Summer Camp, and I waited patiently for the summer to end, and about September Trapper Bob came back and evacuated my bats, where they became someone else's problem.
How do you evacuate bats?
It's actually really interesting. They look for all the holes that they're getting in from, and they seal them all up except one, and then they put like a sock on that one so that the bats can go out the sock, but they can't get back in.
Oh.
So when they go out at night to feed on mosquitoes, they can't get back in, and they just go find someplace else to live. And then once after about 2 weeks, you're convinced they're all out, then you seal up that hole. No more bats, and no bats had to die in my walls.
Well, that's a very nice ending to that story. I kind of like bats. I feel like I should buy you the book Luna. You know Luna?
Oh, yes. I do like bats, too. I just didn't want them in my walls.
But I have to admit, after I heard your story at the Moth, and I thought about the number of times that I've walked down under the Wall Street overpass, even during the day, and I've heard this, I said, I think I hear that help me sound. Unfortunately, there was a savior for our bats during Hurricane Harvey, who helped save quite a number of bats under the bridge. Okay, back on holidays. Do you have a favorite Christmas story of your own while you were growing up?
You know, I had a really just happy, pleasant, middle-class, suburban childhood, so one story doesn't stand out. I had four brothers, and we fought a lot, but we also, you know, had a good time growing up. I remember, you know, we had this house, it had this, my father built his dream house, right? And, it had this second story solarium kind of things, all these windows. We would put a Christmas tree in the front of the house. And then one year we thought it was so cool. My parents got a ginormous, super tall, two story tall Christmas tree for the solarium area. And we had in the living room upstairs, we had a balcony that kind of overlooked the solarium. And so we thought it was so cool to like throw things over the solarium and try to catch them in the tree, or, you know, put ornaments on from over two stories up. So, oh, you know, actually, here's one. So in that same area, I don't know if it's that same house we lived in, but I do remember I grew up in the Salt Lake area mostly, and we used to go to my grandparents' house on Christmas Eve. And one year, and we lived up in Bountiful in the foothills where it would get a lot more snow at times. And we went to visit my grandparents for Christmas Eve. And then on our way back, it snowed so much in the meantime that we got stuck. We couldn't get up the hill. So here's me and my four brothers. We're all dressed, you know, in our pajamas, ready for Christmas Eve, and we're stuck in the snow at like 10 o'clock on Christmas Eve, about a half mile from the house. So we all just pile out of the Suburban and we just truck on through the snow up the rest of the way home and, you know, dry off and snuggle up in bed and go to sleep. So I remember that Christmas was a particularly exciting one for us.
Yeah, when you have to abandon a car in the snow, that's that's a little thrilling. I one time flew into Washington, D.C., and I think we were the last plane to land at Reagan Airport. And we made our way around, and finally our shuttle stopped about four or five blocks before we got to our hotel. It was sometime in the middle of December, or maybe the middle of January, and he said, we can't go any further, but we're within walking distance. So we got out and trudged along. Of course, I'm wearing Texas shoes, Texas clothes, and we walked through, and we got to the hotel. And what's interesting is I was there for a meeting, is there were all these stranded people who couldn't get home. And they were asking people who would come to the meeting if we would double up with someone that we knew so they could free up a room and so on. But I remember that. It's because, as you may well know from the snow that we just had here in Houston, that those little sprinklings that happen, the city may be shut down. Mm-hmm. But it's not exactly quite the same as happens, you know, up in the Northeast. Jennifer, you're a great storyteller. So I need to ask you, was there a storyteller in your family? Is this a tradition? Or did you just start it on your own?
Well, I like to think my mom was a storyteller. She probably wouldn't say that she is, but I like to say I'm a good mix of my parents. My dad is a real type A Excel spreadsheet kind of guy, and my mom is much more exuberant and creative, and she used to write little plays for church at times. I remember being in things that she had written, or going to see things that she was in. So she, she had a song group. They would sing. These bunch of suburban housewives got together, the singing group, and they would sing. So there's that creative side in her that I feel like I got. And I've got some great stories from my mom that I promised her I wouldn't tell tonight. maybe another night.
I'm going to have to take you out to dinner again.
Yes. Yes. So I learned, you know, sitting around with my mom, I think, learned how to craft a story, because she's just a really neat lady.
And you mentioned that you had written some plays, that you've dabbled in playwriting yourself.
I have written one full-length play, and dabbled is a good word for other things I've started. I've started several, written maybe a one act here and there, but I did a couple of years ago finish a full-length play, and I've been submitting it around to competitions and
stuff.
It's about, funny enough, chronic pain. But it's funny in, it's, you know, it has its humorous moments. It's taking a serious but light look on the life of chronic pain sufferer.
Oh, that's so good to know. That's good to know. Yeah. I think I mentioned to you over dinner, so I have a friend who's in chronic pain, and it's a journey you don't know unless you've experienced it.
No.
I think. So I think you can tell us one more story. I know you have a couple about your son. One's about his library, his desire to always go to the library and learn. But there's another really cute one from his point of view that I like.
Okay.
Where it's, and it reminds me, I have this good friend who's a poet, and he wrote a poem when his wife was pregnant and having a baby about him as the father and making the cradle, and the symbol was making the baby together and the birth of the baby. And it's a very serious and moving poem. And he was at a reading. He said, "Now I'm going to tell you the point of view of the poem from the baby." And the baby's boom, bop, boom, bop, boom, bop. And when he finally comes out, he said, "Oh my God, I finished it. It's a woman and she looks fine." And so I know you have a story from the point of view of your son.
Yes. So, one quick comment you made me think of. When I was home alone with my first baby, you know, just me and the baby, I found myself talking to the baby, and I'm not good at baby talking, so I created a whole mama baby code, because I worked in waste regulations, and so I created this code that my husband would come home and I'd tell him about all the violations that I had made in the mama baby code in the voice of my infant. And I think my husband thought I was going a little crazy, but I think it was keeping me sane. But that's not this story. This story is actually about my second son, my younger son. So my oldest son's getting off a little bit tonight. He got the Mary story. So
he got the Mary story. That was a good one.
This is
go, Ethan, go.
Yes, this is Elliot. This is it from YMCA Camp Greenville, again in Fairyland. Again, it's 30 to 45 minutes to go anywhere. So, we would go to the library regularly. So this is written from his perspective. It's called Confessions of a 2-Year-Old. In my defense, let me first say that I was not given a proper nap on the day in question. Being 2 years old, I cannot be reasonably expected to behave myself, even within 2-year-old standards of decorum, in a public place under such circumstances. Secondly, I did not ask to be taken inside. Granted, I wanted out of my car seat, but this did not necessarily mean that I had to be taken inside. It was my mother's idea to take me in and change my diaper. In a public restroom, of all places, on a cold, hard counter. Needless to say, I had not been set up for success. So we left the bathroom, the ladies' room, mind you. I think I've been more than patient with being constantly hauled into the women's restroom and undressed in the wide open for all passers-by to see me in all my glory, thank you. Mom said she just needed to pick up some books being held at the library counter, but then she stops at the first bookshelf she comes to and looks over the books. I think it's a library conspiracy, you see. Rather than file all the books nicely away in the back of the boring grown-up section, they take the most exciting, shiny new ones and put them on a shelf right up front where mothers can't help but walk past them on their way out of the library. What, like I can just leave my mom at home and drive myself to the library? They know I have to bring her with me. Like they know that she's going to have to stop at that shelf and have a look-see. What is a kid supposed to do? I did what any self-respecting, tired, bored toddler would do. I took off running down the stacks of books. Mom, of course, took off after me, grabbed me like a sack of potatoes, and hauled me back up front like I had been the one who misbehaved. What did she expect? How else could a kid as small as me get her to tear herself away from the shiny new bookshelf? So we go up to the desk. right next to the book return, I might add. The lady goes to the back to find her books, but not before giving me one of those "I know your kind" looks. What? I'm two. What do you expect? I'm going to destroy something sooner or later. It's not my fault we're here in the first place. While Mom is waiting, I have absolutely nothing to do. I want to help, so I go over to the book return to see if I can help. Mom says, "We don't have any books to return today." Jeez, lady, can't we plan ahead? The best part of going to the library is putting stuff in the book return slot. But I figured, if she doesn't have any books for me, hey, no problem, I'm resourceful. I trot right on over to the new bookshelf and grab one from there. But before I can even put it in the slot, Mom gets all excited again and runs over and grabs the thing out of my hands. I was just trying to help. She is so embarrassing sometimes. It made me so mad that I took off down the stacks again. I'll show her. Sometimes it just isn't fair that I am so much smaller. I'd be much faster than her if my legs were just a little bit longer. I mean, really, have you seen her run? She says she has Grandpa's bad knees, but I think she still has some baby belly, if you know what I mean. Nonetheless, she catches me again, hauls me back up front, and now expects me to stand there while the lady checks out the books. I tried. I really did try. But then she starts asking a question about this book and the other CD, and really, what do you expect? Was I supposed to just stand there, bored out of my mind? Of course not. I did what any self-respecting, tired, angry toddler would do. I ran right back over to the shiny new books, whereupon I promptly noticed the little statue they have sitting there and absolutely could not help myself. It's a statue of another little boy, and everyone knows I'm egocentric. Did I mention I'm two? I thought, hey, he looks a little like me. On a normal day, I might have settled with just touching the statue, but after all I had gone through that day, I was justifiably angry. And well, I grabbed a hold of the statue and pulled it right over. I figured I'd just make a little scene. They'd stand it back up, and my point would be made. How was I supposed to know it'd break into pieces? They don't teach you that kind of thing at home. Everything breakable has been removed entirely from my reach in my home environment. It's almost like they've done it on purpose, like they don't want me to be able to touch anything breakable. Well, I guess I showed my mom this and the snooty library lady, too. They acted like the little statue was really important or something. Well, if it was so special, maybe they shouldn't have left it out where an angry toddler can reach it. Mom didn't say much on the way home. Maybe she learned a lesson today. I can't wait to go back to the library. Signed, Elliot.
Yes. So has Elliot signed off on that version?
Probably not. I told them I was going to embarrass them both tonight, so.
Oh, yes, definitely. Out of the mouths of babes and out of the mouths of babes. Yes, I also have a, well, she is 24 now, but when she was 5, that people would ask me, how old is your daughter? I'm like, well, she's 5 going on 35. Mm-hmm. Yes. And she certainly tried to tell me how to do things in kind of the same kind of way. And I do remember one time when I was pregnant with my second daughter, and I had my older daughter at the Museum of Natural History, and I think she realized she had an advantage here. You know, pregnant mom was not going to be able to do very much. And at one point, she threw herself on the floor and was having a fit. And these two girls walked by who were about 20, 21 years old, and I saw them look at her and then look at me in total disgust. And I thought to myself, yep, when I was 20, I gave that same look to people like me, but you just wait, honey. You just wait. It'll happen to you.
Do I have time for a quick story about that museum?
Go for it.
So my son, my older son, the one who likes to understand how everything works, one time we were in the basement of that museum where they do the little experiments for kids, and of course my older son was bored with that, but Elliot wanted to see the experiment, so I'm watching the experiment, and Ethan wanders over to the big periodic table they have over there. He's about 9, but loves the periodic table at this time, and so he's fine looking at the periodic table. I turn my attention back, and when the experiment's done, I look over there at the periodic table, and I see this 9-10-year-old holding court. He's got about 4 or 5 adults in front of him, and he's explaining, using the periodic table, how some poisonous gas or something or other is made when you combine this element with that element, and I'm like, wow, that's my kid.
Oh, that's amazing. That's fun. This has been a really, really fun night.
Yes.
So, Jennifer, it was your first time on the radio, and is there anybody special in Radio Land you want to say goodnight to?
Well, my kids, who I've embarrassed, I love you, and shout out to them. They're the source of so many of my stories, and my husband's listening too. And my mom, my inspiration, and is hopefully listening too in Utah, so shout out to her.
Oh, great. Hey, Utah's an hour behind, so she should be able to get us easily. Yeah. And everybody... well, of course, you're all listening, but to everybody who knows somebody who missed the show, all you have to do is go to HoustonStorytellers.org and just Google it, find it, find the website, go to radio programs, and you will go down and it will say December 20th, Dr. Mary Edgerton with Jennifer Hoisington, and you can listen to the whole show again. So, Jennifer, that was great. That was a lot of fun.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun. I had a great time.
And I hope to see you more in Storytelling Land here in Houston.
Definitely.
Well, we're coming to the end of our night. I guess I should, I do want to share with you, I don't often get to talk about myself as a storyteller. So you mentioned your mother was the storyteller. My dad was the storyteller. And he would regale us at night with stories of our family and our town and our pets and our cows as we raised cows. And he would read to us in all the different voices and everything. And my mother, I asked my brother one time, because I've had him on the show, I said, you know, who do you think our storyteller was? And he said, well, it had to be our father. And I said, didn't Mom ever tell us any stories? And he said, oh, Mom always had these stories about where her pet died or... somebody came home with a rabbit after hunting and they all thought it was the Easter rabbit. And I remembered that and I thought, yeah, it was our dad who was our storyteller. But I think there is somebody in every family.
Mm-hmm.
And who do you think is going to be the storyteller after you?
Elliot, probably.
The younger one?
Yeah.
Ethan is the, how does it work?
Yes, he's my engineer. Elliot can talk his way out of anything.
Oh, well, that's good to know. If I'm ever speeding, I want Elliot in the car with me. Well, okay, everybody out there, don't move, because Wild Bill and the Vinyl Avengers are ready in the wings to share their cool classics with you. Yes, for this hour, you heard cool classic stories. And in the next hour, you're going to hear cool classic vinyl. Make 90.1 a part of every day, and while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Wednesday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And treasure what you hear. Keep loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. This is Mary Edgerton, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace. And thank you, Jennifer, and welcome to Houston Storyland.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thousands of you have heeded the call, but there's always room for more. You can find KPFT on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. From our latest updates to funny videos, contests, news, and more, you can find us anytime, day or night. We're at KPFT Houston on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. We'd love to give you the latest. Plus, you're already on Facebook. Why not get behind the scenes of Houston's leader for independent music, arts, ideas, and culture right now? Again, find us at KPFT Houston on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. See you there.
We want to thank you, the listeners, and those who contributed to our successful fall fund drive. This is Interim General Manager Larry Winters asking you to please consider a year-end